Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading today for you in digest form, World Radio Magazine for the month of September, the year 2008. World Radio is published by Armand Noble. His call is N6WR. The editor is Nancy Cott, WCHC. They're headquartered at World Radio Incorporated, 2120 28th Street, Sacramento, California, 95818. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Handyham here is spelled, this is all lowercase, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word, handyham@courage.org. The website, www.handyham.org. Let's begin today with the commentary by the editor, Nancy Cott. The editor's log. If you've been to a ham fest, looked at an internet reflector or picked up a ham magazine over the last decade, you have seen the slogan, if it's not CW, it's CB. Although the slogan is an example of how strongly some amateurs feel about Morse code, the point is that proficiency in Morse code is something to be proud of and is a mode that sets amateur radio apart from a citizen's band. We might also use the slogan, if you don't follow the regulations, it will be CB. FCC rules and regulations apply to everything involved with amateur radio, from our testing procedures to our on-air activities. Our compliance sets us apart from the mayhem often heard on the citizen band radio and gives an amateur a reputation of respectability and civility, making it a hobby and public service of which we can be proud. With the distinction between the licensing classes blurring and written exams becoming less technical and accessible, more people are sharing the bands that used to be sharply divided by license class. Vanity call signs make it impossible to tell the license class of the operator, unless you have a computer and check one of the lookup services online while you are on the air. We operate from the privacy of our own shacks, special events, and field day, where the chance of having an FCC official looking over your shoulder is highly unlikely. Every year around field day time, many amateurs are under the misconception that the rules are thrown to the wind and non-hams and hams with lower privileges can get on the air and operate whenever they want. I get letters complaining about John Johnston. Call W3BE's Rules and Regs Field Day column, where he explains that the rules do not change just because it has been declared field day. Surely, they write, the FCC has bigger fish to fry than insisting we follow the rules to the letter. Yes, the FCC does have bigger fish to fry, and as I said, the odds of being caught are next to none. That is not the point. Breaking the rules is breaking the rules. One of the things that sets us apart from citizens' band is we take pride in our regulations, or at least we should. Amateur radio has a tradition of being self-policing. The ARRL, the American Radio Relay League, even has a corps of official observers, OOs, to monitor the bands and mail notices of infraction to those who are operating outside the regulations. Official observers are not radio police, but exist to help with self-regulation by letting people know that they have a problem with their transmitter or are operating against the rules, hopefully to nip any problems in the bud. Oftentimes, people do not know they have a problem until someone tells them. Understanding the regulations is the first step in compliance. Compliance is essential. No matter how petty or small the issue may seem to you or your club, being lax will unravel a fabric that holds us together and sets us apart as an elite faction on the air. Once it is gone, will not get it back. September is FISTS, Anniversary Celebration Month. That's F-I-S-T-S. 21 years. Everyone is welcome to join in the G3ZQS Memorial Strait Key event, 2300 Zulu September 5 to 2300 Zulu September 7, and the Get Your Feet Wet Weekend 0 Zulu, Friday September 12, that's a Thursday local time, to 0 Zulu September 15, Sunday time local. The details are on http://www.fists.org. Now, for our listeners, if you'd like to contact Nancy Kott, K-O-T-T, you can contact her via email at nancy@tir.com or via the editor, that is editor, E-D-I-T-O-R, at wr6wr.com. Or if you don't have email capabilities on the Internet, you can write to Nancy, WCHC, at P.O. Box 807, Hadley, H-A-D-L-E-Y, Michigan, M-I, 48440. Before we get into the actual featured articles for this month's issue of World Radio, let's look at News Front. World Radio News Front. Amateur radio news courtesy of the ARRL letter and Newsline. Our first piece is titled W4PL, Whiskey 4, Papa Lima, Hatteras Island, Area NA067 Activation. Members of the Tennessee Valley DX Association will activate Hatteras Island using the call sign W4PL. This island is part of the North Carolina State East Group, IOTA NA067. This call sign, W4PL, plans on being QRV, about 1900 Zulu, Saturday, 27 September 2008, and will go QRT, Saturday, 04 October 2008. QRV means to be ready to go on the air. That's a Q signal shorthand in amateur radio, and QRT means to go off the air. The group will use 100-watt transceivers and plan to be active on 10 through 80 meters high frequency, that's HF, either single sideband, CW, with some PSK and RTTY, and 6 meters, SSB and CW. If you would like a confirmation card, please QSL via K4KWK, that's K4KWK, directly, and use a self-addressed stamped envelope or via the Bureau. Additional information will be added on our website at www.tvdxa.com during and following the activation. That was filed by WA4AA. Also, Texas QSO Party. Bexar Operations Group W5BOG will be active from the Texas QSO Party, 1400 Zulu, 27 September through 2000 Zulu, 28 September 2008, with a break in between. The event will be located at the Gardner State Park, which is 234RR1050, CONCAN, that's C-O-N-C-A-N, Texas. We have chosen to deploy at a tent site with water and electric. The reservation has been put in place. We will stress battery operation of our station or stations so as to better determine capacity versus duty cycle on high frequency using both single sideband and CW. Since the majority of our contacts will be within the Texas area, it will also be an opportunity to do a direct comparison between two types of NVIS antennas using identical rigs. Both antennas will be aligned in the same direction. This will establish how efficient they are for emergency communications work and if they have any directive pattern. We have proven the usefulness of NVIS antennas for lower noise floor, higher readability reception, even if NVIS signals aren't generated, in a series of earlier tests on this year and last year. If anyone wishes to test other NVIS antennas against the two we will be using, please feel free to bring them. Additional tents will be available to accommodate more folks. If you wish, you may bring your own shelter, sleeping bag, and or make your own reservations at the park. There is a park entry fee. Check their website for additional details. Food and drink in limited amounts will be available. A grill will be operational for BYOers, filed by W5BOG. Well, we've been hearing a lot about China. Here's a commentary on Newsfront. China praises its ham community. Reports on the Chinese national TV network News said that when all other communication means failed, amateur radio operators came out to provide valuable first-hand information from the center of the earthquake disasters. This included a high-frequency link for the Red Cross from the disaster area back to the nation's capital city of Beijing, enabling that aid agency to do its essential humanitarian work. Other reports said that BY8AA, Bravo Yankee 8 Alpha Alpha, continuously coordinated VHF, that's very high frequency, and UHF, ultra high, communications for 100 kilometers radius from the capital of southwest China's province of Sichuan. Additional repeaters were set up in two other cities that were among the worst hit areas outside the epicenter. This formed an effective amateur radio relay communication network. That was filed by AR Newsline. The following submission here indicates a little bit about how important it is for state governments and financing to sometimes help amateur radio's good causes. It's titled $250,000 Grant to Oregon, A-R-E-S. That's Amateur Radio Emergency Services. Jackson County, Oregon, A-R-E-S, is using state grant money awarded to it earlier this year to purchase digital communications equipment for ARIS chapters in each Oregon county. The award was due to the work of ARIS operators last December when they provided backup communications to coastal communities during the winter storms. Those storms were some of the worst in decades. They knocked out both landline and cellular phone service to a number of coastal communities for several days. The tiny community of Veronia was entirely cut off from the rest of Oregon by flooding and landslides. It fell to amateur radio operators to direct research crews to residents stranded in Veronia and other hard-hit areas, while informing hospitals that patients were on the way. Don Montgomery, called WB7Q, is the emergency coordinator for Jackson County. The group has established some 20 ARIS stations throughout the county. A company called Mercy Flights recently donated a retired ambulance to the group. WB7Q says it's in the process of being converted into an emergency communications vehicle with a full complement of radio equipment on board. And we thank the OregonMailTribune.com through AR Newsline for providing that information and encouragement perhaps for other states to offer financial assistance. ARRL, Emergency Communications CD. If you are involved in any way in the emergency communications aspect of amateur radio, you will want to get a copy of the Emergency Communications Library CD, now being published by the American Radio Relay League. The CD is billed as a quick access source of information and software that every emergency communicator should have on hand. Among the items included are documents and presentations on many aspects of emergency communications operations, the ARRL Field Resource Manual, and Public Service Communications Manuals, software for APORS and WinLink, and a copy of the Bob Darity, Bob's call is K1VV, Kilo 1 Victor Victor, simulated emergency test movie. For ordering information and pricing, you can visit the website of the ARRL. Go to www.arrl.org/SHOP. Now, rounding out the World Radio Newsfront information pieces for this month, Young Ham of the Year Award. Emily Stewart, called KC0PTL, that's Kilo Charlie 0 Papa Tango Lima, was chosen as the 2008 Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year. The 17-year-old from Leavenworth, Kansas, with interests as diverse as astronomy, spaceflight, pharmacy, and public service using ham radio, is the daughter of Mike and Sharon Stewart. Mike is call sign K0MDS. This fall, Emily is heading into her senior year at Leavenworth High School, where she's a member of the National Honor Society, vice president of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and is a copy editor for the school yearbook. Emily says she has lived in Kansas for 8 years. Prior to that, home was in Germany, where her father was serving in the United States military. She credits her dad for sparking her interest in amateur radio when they moved back to the United States. Quoting her, "I thought it was really cool when he started talking to people overseas in Europe," close quote, Emily recalls. She continues, "And Germany was still kind of home to me, so when he started talking to people in Germany, I said I wanted to do that too." Emily earned her technician license in August of 2003. She upgraded to general class in April 2007. She says she was so excited about her new hobby that she wanted to share it with others and made presentations at school during her 6th and 7th grade years. That led to her getting active in her local radio club and even contributing articles to the club newsletter. Emily's activity also led to her appointment as the first assistant section manager for youth in the ARRL Kansas section, a job she has held since 2006. Emily says her other ham radio passions are public service and storm spotting. Quoting again, "My dad would sometimes take me out with him to go storm spotting, and I decided that I wanted to have some training, so I took a couple of online courses in emergency communications," Emily says. "And either I will go out with my dad when we get called out to do some storm chasing, or I will stay at home and do spotting from home just in case something really nasty does happen. Then that way I'm home with my mom." Emily's public service is not limited to ham radio. She is a volunteer at the local Leavenworth Pharmacy, an ongoing experience that she calls very rewarding. She is already a registered pharmacy technician with the state of Kansas and is considering making pharmacy her career. Emily also has a deep interest in space flight and astronomy. Her second cousin, U.S. astronaut Robert L. Stewart, who flew on 2 shuttle missions on the Challenger and Atlantis spacecrafts. She has been attending space camp since she was in the 6th grade. Emily was nominated by Susan Bax, KC0JCR, the wife of Paul Bax, KC0JCQ, Leavenworth's emergency coordinator for ARIS activities. Susan summarizes Emily this way: "Her leadership, her outreach, technical and public service achievements mark her as an outstanding example to other young amateurs." The 2008 Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award will be presented to Emily Saturday, 16 August, 08, at the Huntsville Ham Fest in Huntsville, Alabama. At the award ceremony, Emily received, courtesy of Vertex Standard, an expense-paid trip to the Huntsville Hamfest, along with a gift of Yaesu brand radio equipment. CQ Magazine treated her to an expense-paid week at Space Camp Huntsville and presented Emily with a variety of CQ products. Amateur Radio Newsline will present Emily with a commemorative plaque at the award ceremony. Once again, the cost of this year's plaque was underwritten by Dave Bell. Dave's call, W6AQ, president of DBA Entertainment Incorporated, Hollywood, California. We thank Newsline for that information. Up next here is a featured piece titled "Add Some Spice by Going Portable." The author, Tom Paine, P-A-I-N-E. Tom's call is KN6BN. "My whole amateur radio life has been spent as a California amateur, starting in the mid-1960s as a teenager with my novice ticket. A problem with being a California ham is that we are definitely not DX stations. There is an abundance of California stations on the air, and there are times when I can call CQ for 20 to 30 minutes without a reply, even when I know the band is open. Working CW or PSK 31 is better, but SSB is a challenge, especially with my modest 100-watt home station and a multi-band vertical antenna. So I look forward to October when I am actually a desirable log entry. I am not a series contester, but I love the California CUSO party. This is a time when I can be reassured that my station is actually quite functional, and my signals can be heard across the United States and on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. But this past year, I decided to try something a little different. To add even more spice to my CUSO party operation, I decided to go portable from ocean to desert. I have a sailboat tied up in Mission Bay in San Diego and made this my first portable station. I packed up my ICOM 735 and the Lanco DR119. For antennas, I included hamstick type helically wound verticals for 80 through 10 meters and a Hustler SF2 for 2 meters. An FMJ antenna tuner completed my station equipment. At the boat, I have the option of running off battery power, just as my VHF marine band radio does. There's also the option of shore power at the boat slip. I went ahead and connected my mobile wiring harness to the battery with large alligator clips and positioned the solar panel to help charge the battery. But the 20-watt panel was more for moral support than actually keeping the battery charged for very long. I have an antenna mount on the stern rail of the boat, and this was very handy for screwing in the various antennas I had brought along. The stern rail connects through stainless steel lifelines to stanchions along the outside of the deck and up to the stainless bow pulpit up front. This arrangement, together with the seawater right underneath, seems to make quite an effective counterpoise to ground. One other trick that I learned from reading Gordon West's columns in Sailing Magazine includes clamping a length of copper braid to the stern pulpit and letting it hang down a couple of feet into the salt water. So I fired up the station and made a few simplex contacts on 2 meters, then switched to a high-frequency single sideband and reached 9 stations in 5 states in an hour or so. Not very impressive, but band conditions were poor. My station was small, and besides, I was having a good time. But I was getting edgy to move on, so the equipment was packed up and the boat was closed up. Everything was moved to the van for my next stop in the portable adventure. From Mission Bay to the nearby Laguna and Coyamaca Mountains is about a 55-mile drive to the east. I had decided to take the equipment at my Ford van to a location near Kitchen Creek at an elevation just under 4,000 feet. After arriving at my destination, I used the antenna mount on the roof rack to mount the antennas. It's actually the same kind of clamping-style aluminum mount that I use on the boat rail. So again, I set up the equipment, connected to the van's battery, and called CQ. I had a harder time making contacts and hearing other stations than I did on the boat. I blame this on the less conductive ground. But the nearby mountain peaks could have been blocking some signals as well. After enjoying the serenity of the mountains, only infrequently punctuated with an actual radio contact, it was time to move on to my last operating location. Once again, I packed up the equipment. The next stop was again traveling east, this time about 35 miles to a spot near the desert town of Ocotillo in Imperial County. I dropped from about 4,000 feet elevation back down to sea level. This is about as bleak as I can imagine any desert could be, but it does have a certain attractiveness to it if you look for the beauty and if you bring plenty of water. Once more using the shelter of the van as a portable radio shack, I set up the station and went to work on the ham bands. Not much activity for me here. Again, I partially blame the rocky, sandy, non-conductive ground as well as the mountain range, which now completely blocked my signals to the west. The area to the east of me was sparsely populated, and I could make no 2-meter simplex contacts either. There are a couple of repeaters on the nearby mountain peaks that I could have employed, but that was all I could do on VHF. HF single sideband was a bust also. I made 2 contacts in nearby Arizona and 1 in California. It was time to pack up again and go home to San Diego. The drive took me out of the desert, back up and through the mountains and down again into San Diego. Was it worth the time and trouble? Yes. It would have been a fun road trip even without the ham radio. But the challenge of setting up my station and operating from 3 very different environments was a lot of fun, at least for me, and my wife was a good sport about the whole thing. I'm sure that I would have made more contacts staying at home, but at this time in the sunspot cycle, the bands aren't great for a modest station, with a modest antenna anyway. So we did something different and enjoyed it. The author Tom Payne called Kilo November 6, Bravo November, KN6BN, submitted for publication several photographs which are reproduced on these pages of the article titled Add Some Spice by Going Portable. Well, now we have a piece from the publisher, Armand Noble, called N6WR. It's titled Field Day 2008. CQ Field Day. CQ Field Day. More amateur radio operators participate in Field Day than in any other event. The American Radio Relay League started it in 1933. I may be dating myself to point that I've been in about half of them. It's a great recruiting tool, not just to all the people who might see a Field Day group set up in a park. We're talking about when you go to work Monday with a sunburn, bug bites, and a raspy voice from calling CQ so many times and bleary eyes from a lack of sleep. Your coworkers will ask, what happened to you? And you can tell them how much fun you had. Daily DX, that's the title, called it Recovery Monday. But there's a real purpose behind all the madness. Besides the cookout and hanging around with fellas and gal club members, it is indeed a test of emergency communications. You can't plug your radio in the wall. You can't use any pre-existing antennas or structures. You use whatever you can take with you to wherever you are going. It all starts Saturday morning, always the last full weekend in June, and finishes on Sunday. Should you set up your station ahead of the start time, you get 24 hours of operation. The Le Mans start, that is, starting from scratch. People get 27 hours. Throughout the United States and Canada, nearly 35,000 operators organized in over 2,000 groups take part. There's a motto about the ability of amateur radio to provide needed communications in emergency conditions when all else fails. Field Day is the reason. U.S. Army has a saying, if you train like you're fighting, you'll fight like you're trained. After Field Day, many clubs have critiques. What went well and what was the victim of Murphy's Law? Then, in mid-November, comes the results in QSD magazine, and clubs can see how well we did, or, we'll do better next year. A recent addition to the event is inviting officials of the various civic and relief organizations to visit the Field Day sites and see amateur radio in action. The World Radio Magazine staff, Amateur Radio Club, ran an ICONS IC718. We ran it at 80 watts instead of 100 watts, so the battery would last longer, and received many comments about nice signal. With a dipole and a vertical, we made 356 contacts, 19 on 15 meters, 193 on 20 meters, 97 on 40 meters, and 47 on 75 meters. At our ages, we stopped for some sleep. And thanks to the many who, when hearing WR6WR, stopped and told us how much they liked the magazine. That was appreciated. There's a lot of Field Day lore. The Englewood, New Jersey Amateur Radio Association has been on 49 consecutive Field Days. A TV station in Sacramento devoted over 2 minutes to a newscast showing a science teacher taking young students on field day. We'd love to hear from you what things your club did or what lessons you learned. Many groups notify their local newspaper, and as a result, there is coverage so the community can learn more about amateur radio. There have been times that hams on the exercise have been called away to do their part in an actual emergency. And when it all ends on Sunday, one thinks, gee, we have to wait another whole year till we can do it again. Thanks a lot, Armin, for a Field Day 2008 commentary. Let's move along now to emergency communications. Critical path analysis. The author, Jerry Wellman. Jerry's call is W7SAR, Whiskey 7 Sierra Alpha Romeo. For those of you with some project management experience, you'll recognize the term critical path analysis. If you're familiar with the concept, skip the next few paragraphs. Well, we can't do that here, folks. We'll read them. Let me give you an example. I'm planning on replacing the shingles on my roof and have hired some roofers to do the labor with the understanding that I'll get all the supplies. If the roofers arrive before the shingles, the project won't happen within my budget, as I'll have to pay them extra hours while they wait. If the delivery of the shingles isn't made to the roof, the workers are not going to hoist the bundles onto the roof. There's a critical path of events that must occur in proper order and with proper timing for the project to happen effectively. We're not including outside influences such as a thunderstorm or an earthquake. We're just talking about the elements of the project that must happen in a certain timely order for the best conclusion. What if the workers are on site and the shingles are on the roof, but the nails don't arrive? What if all the materials are there, but no workers show up? The outcome of the project is on time, on budget, or late and on budget, or perhaps late and over budget. Worst case scenario is simply not completed. When you diagram the project, certain elements are critical, without which the project cannot be completed. All of these elements, in their proper order and scheduling, create the critical path. Let's apply this to an amateur radio response to an event. Can you think of critical elements? What if the radio was there but no operator? Or the EOC had radios but no licensed operators? A few months ago, a fellow responded to an emergency incident but neglected to bring the proper microphone for his radio. He was limited in his ability to program the radio, and this affected his effectiveness. Today, I got a call from a fellow who was supporting a youth activity. One of his radios was missing a fuse, and did I have any suggestions or concerns if they just spliced around the fuse? I've been on events where I've needed an adapter to match coax to a radio or an antenna. My vehicle can be full of gear, but without the needed adapter, I could not fulfill my communication role. Sometimes we can splice a wire or make temporary modifications to allow our project to be completed. Sometimes a missing and critical part would delay or prevent our project from happening. The concept for you is to consider the critical path for your communications response and to plan accordingly. For some, it's ensuring you have a checklist of necessary items and making sure each item is included. Sometimes it's carrying spares or redundant systems. I have been chided, and you may have also been subject to this kidding as well, by well-meaning associates who chuckle at my bringing a lot of spares or complete extra systems. I've been asked why I have a spare radio, several runs of spare coax, a box of adapters, a spare antenna, and a spare radio. After all, I've been told, you could just borrow a radio if you needed one. Sharing and borrowing of gear is great, as long as the gear is there and the owner is willing to lend. My message is to plan on self-sufficiency and have the mindset of looking at your own gear before you go and ensuring you have critical items. I've been able to splice or repair coax, but this depends on the size of the coax, the temperature of the coax. Try fixing coax in sub-zero weather, if you see what I mean, and having time to complete the repairs. Having all sorts of things fail at the worst possible time, fail when they were not supposed to, and have loaned stuff to others, never to see it again. It would be a nice world if every radio had the same antenna and power and microphone connector. It would be great if every antenna had the same connector. It would be great if every fuse was the same size and shape. At one time, I was rewiring connectors on my radio so any microphone would be interchangeable. It worked for a while as I replaced 4, 5, and 6-pin connectors with 8-pin connectors and made sure the wiring was standard. And then came some ArcJ45 connectors and other DIN connectors. And I don't have to make adapters in order to have everything match. It became too daunting a task, and I've abandoned trying. For a while, my fuse box only had glass fuses, and they were of the same physical size. If I needed a fuse, I could find a match, or at least find a fuse that would fit in an emergency. And then came blade fuses, tiny ones, medium ones, big ones, and glass fuses in small sizes. Now my fuse box has quite an assortment, and I've no assurance that I will have the proper one or could quickly find it. In my response gear, I have an adapter kit that allows me to create RF adapter so I can match coax and antenna and radio. It was great as long as all of the various adapter ends were used by manufacturers. And then came SMA and TNC connectors. There were mini UHF connectors. I had to buy some additional parts for my adapter kit to be of value. Who knows what new connector will be included next? It's frustrating. But here's the advice for you. Please look at your own gear and ensure you have critical components so you can complete your project. Before you leave, ensure you have spare fuses for the radios you have with you. Before you leave, ensure you have coax with proper connectors and have a spare. You might want to check the set screws on critical antennas. One operator reported the whip was missing from his vehicle antenna and must have fallen out en route. The systems you need to evaluate are the needed systems for your response. I may have a CB radio as well as a VHF radio in my vehicle. If I'm expected to use the VHF radio for the event, that's the critical system I need to check. My advice? Use a checklist. Check the connectors. Bring spares. Don't go crazy and duplicate everything. Just plan for the most expected failures. If you're new at responding and supporting communications, please ask some experienced folks for suggestions. This makes a great roundtable discussion for your next meeting. For example, sharing failure stories and talking through ideas on how to complete the project when the critical items fail. Well, until next month, best wishes from Salt Lake City, Utah. The author, Jerry Wellman, called W7SAR. Can be reached by sending mail to P.O. Box 11445, Salt Lake City, Utah, UT, zip code 84147, or you can send him an email to lowercase initials jw at desnews.com. So that's jw at desnews.com. We have here a promotion and recruitment article. It's titled Building Amateur Radios Network. The author is Devere D. Logan. Call is W1HEO. The challenge of getting out of our comfortable radio shacks and introducing people to the wonderful world of ham radio requires a few messengers. There are lots of opportunities awaiting. So who among us will volunteer to tell the public about amateur radio? Raise your hands, please. A small group. Typical of some radio clubs. The old saying, the harvest is large, but laborers are few, probably applies to many groups, not just radio clubs. How then can we multiply the efforts of the few to reach the many? One answer is networking. We can define a network as a loose-knit organization of persons who understand amateur radio and are in a position to tell others about it. Right up front, let's note that while newspapers, radio, TV station journalists should be included, they represent only a small portion of the network potential. One reason is that today these traditional news media are shrinking as the internet grows, resulting in less advertising and fewer pages devoted to news. Sorry, but the media doesn't consider publicity for ham radio to be news. Before we consider approaching potential members of our network, we should figure out a way to offer them something rather than just trying to sell ham radio. What's in it for them? For example, many teachers are interested in ways to add to or enrich their teaching efforts. Amateur radio is ideal for teachers of a variety of subjects. Science and physics instructors can use ham radio to show applied principles of electricity, electronics, and math. Geography and language teachers can explain that students could enjoy DX, distant contacts, with other countries and practice their language skills. Computer science students will easily identify with ham radio's digital modes and software-defined radios. And the list goes on. A single teacher can influence many students and thus multiply the impact of a single briefing on ham radio. Now, as regards to building a network, our presentation should be developed with this in mind. It helps to draft the main points and know them well before we communicate them. A simple outline can cover the main points, including what the amateur radio service is, its typical uses, its attraction as a hobby and public service, along with the licensing procedure. Having literature to leave with the targeted network member can provide an easy follow-up. Our presentation, or the pitch, as some people call it, should be simple, delivered ad lib and with enthusiasm that communicates the fun and enjoyment of amateur radio. A personal meeting is best, but sometimes a written message or email will have to do. Who should be targeted to join our network? The best candidates will be influential people such as teachers, but there are many others. Scout leaders are ideal, along with civic club officers, church and youth group organizers, police, fire, security people, newspaper writers, legislators, senior center activity coordinators, and go on and on. In short, anyone who regularly meets with or can influence others can be a spokesman for amateur radio. I recently talked with a local senior center staffer who suggested that ham radio would be a wonderful communication link for shut-ins. This led to our presentation on ham radio with a special senior slant. This was followed by another invitation to speak, this time to a German club. That talk allowed us to emphasize the unique international, cultural, and ethnic connections that amateur radio provides. Chances are your radio club members can identify several other target groups, starting with their own circle of friends and acquaintances. This is a good place to begin. Some target groups pose special challenges. Young people today are surrounded by high-tech devices, and many consider radio old-fashioned. Yet some youths certainly are candidates, especially with computers as a common link. As Raymond Woody Woodworth, called K3VSA, writes, quoting, "People, especially kids, aren't going to seek us out because they've heard we can talk to the world. We have to adapt to the times and actively recruit new hams using the tools that work today. We especially need to publicize our events on the internet sites like Craigslist, where people are looking now. Our clubs must ensure that their websites are attractive and up to date." Randy Hatfield, call AG6RH, notes that ham radio had a much larger recruiting pool of baby boomers. That's people born between 1945 and 1964. With an average age of 53, compared with Generation Y, born between 85 and 2004, who averaged 13 years. There are about 25 million fewer of them, and their lifestyles are different, along with a higher cost of living. Randy says that if we recruited the same percentage of hams as we did in a post-war period, the total would still be much smaller. Another issue is that radio equipment can be quite pricey for some potential hams. Something else for us to ponder. Also, he says, we have our job cut out for us. Now, regarding the establishing of relationships, note that publicity hasn't been mentioned. Why not? True, it's important to promote our ham radio brand, but that usually doesn't result in building a network of advocates. Far from being a one-shot effort, networking helps us build relationships. As we inform more and more individuals about amateur radio, we benefit from this multiplying effect as others spread the word for us. These relationships need to be encouraged and nurtured for the long term. So, we need to keep in touch with our network through regular contacts and updates, sending notices of public service events, field day, radio classes, and perhaps your club newsletter will assure that we will enjoy share of mind as well as recognition. An email from Brent Stover, WD8PNZ, reports that his Toledo, Ohio club is highly visible during events such as charity runs and bike-a-thons with its communication truck and trailer. They work with the Red Cross and the Ohio Medical Corps and certainly build relationships as they participate in public service activities. Brent is actively involved in a legislation action program which focuses on informing elected officials of amateur radio issues that need to be addressed. This is a specialized form of networking, but is vital to ensure that government officials understand our radio service and protect it. The next step in our recruiting process is making it easy for people interested in ham radio to contact an Elmer or mentor. We'll talk about forming an Elmer Corps in a future column. Have you or your radio had success generating interest in our hobby with certain groups? Young people are often considered tough sells, but there are ways of stimulating their interest and curiosity. Let us know what works for other target groups, and we'll share them through this column. The author gives us an email address here. In lowercase, D-E-L-O-G-A-N, at ameritech.net. That's D-Logan at ameritech.net. In the meantime, please try to energize some of your fellow amateurs by encouraging them to begin seeking candidates for your own promotional network. If not us, who? Good luck. It's signed Devere, D. Logan, call W1HEO. Devere is a writer and public relations counselor who is accredited by the Public Relations Society of America and a member of its College of Fellows. Let's see what's going on with hamfests around the United States in September, perhaps October. Start with Colorado. Boulder Amateur Radio Club BAR Fest Amateur Radio and Electronic Swap Meet will be held 28 September at the Boulder County Fairgrounds, Boulder, Colorado. In Connecticut, Candlewood Amateur Radio Association Western Connecticut Hamfest is the 14 September 2008 at the Edmond Town Hall in Newtown, Connecticut. Great State of Illinois. Northern Illinois DX Association will sponsor the W9DXCC Convention and Banquet to be held 20 September 2008 at the Holiday Inn in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. That's near O'Hare Airport. Michigan Grand Rapids Amateur Radio Association will be holding theirs on the 6th of September at the Kent County Fairgrounds in Lowell, Michigan. State of New York MCOM East Convention, 20 September in Rochester, New York. Saratoga County RACES Association, Incorporated. Hamfest is the 13 September 2008 at the Saratoga County Fairgrounds in Ballston Spa, New York. Lovely place. I've been there. State of Ohio, Greater Cincinnati Amateur Radio Association is the 21 September. It's being held at the Diamond Oaks Career Development Center, Cincinnati, Ohio. Little Rhodey, Rhode Island Amateur FM Repeater Services Incorporated Auction and flea market will be held on the 20th of September at the VFW Post 6342 Main Street, Forestdale, North Smithfield, Rhode Island. The beautiful state of Washington, Spokane Hamfest, and American Radio Relay League Washington State Convention. It's hosted by the 8 amateur radio clubs in the Inland Empire. That'll be held on the 27th of September at the University High School in Spokane Valley, Washington. Well, I want to continue now with the YLs column. YLs are young ladies. That's the women who make up amateur radio. YLs are making themselves heard. The contributing author here is Cheryl Muir, call in 0WBV. This column is dedicated to the YLs making contacts on the air, no matter how or why. Yes, YLs have been more active on the air, whether for field day, a new net, or just to take up the challenge. Listen carefully, and you might hear the latest YL operator on the air. Arnold Solomon, called KC4ZUA, sent in this report of YL to YL contact via, you guessed it, an actual letter. Quoting here, history was made on Sunday 25 May when Sylvia Richardson, called KG4OEG, made the first known YL to YL contact via a letter. The recipient of the 20-meter QSO was Courtney Friente, KF6Y, who was operating W9IMS as a participant in the Chick Factor Night festivities at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The historic contact was made during the second annual Strange Antenna Challenge and picnic in Atlanta, Georgia. This major step for YLdom was witnessed by Laurel Rummel, wife of Billy, KI4KGK. Upon making contact, Laurel was so moved that the only question she could ask was how Danica Patrick was doing in the race. Now, regarding Field Day 2008, a number of YLs sent in Field Day reports this year. Hats off to you all. First, from District 3, Jacqueline Gosselin, N3ZEL, writes, "We just got through Field Day and it was a stormy one. We set up the Washington Amateur Communications event at the Washington Sportsman Association again this year. It's on one of the highest hills in the area, and that group has been more than generous to us in allowing us to use their facilities. High winds and violent thunderstorms rolled over us, causing us to shut down at least 3 times. However, we were dry and unscathed, and grateful for it." From District 4, Carol Lafferty, K4SAF, sends us this report. Many YLs participated in Field Day this June. Rosemarie Schiefer, KI4TIE, and her OM, that's Old Man Norm, KD4GMK, helped out the Highlands County ARC of Central Florida. The weather wasn't really cooperative with thunderstorms in their air, but isn't that half the fun? In the South, it always seems to storm on Field Day weekends. Mary Moore, WX4MM, says the East Alabama Radio Club had a great wild turnout this year. She got to operate with both her mom, that's Evelyn Hockersmith, she's now a KJ4EXB, having passed her tech in June. At age 85, she's now studying for her general and her dad. Nancy Morris, K4JD, took part in the Huntsville Amateur Club's Field Day operation. YLs were involved in every aspect of the endeavor, including operating, tower raising, and setup takedown. That's what we like to see. They operated as K4BFT, and I, K4SAF, was one of their contacts. Due to severe weather in northeast Kentucky, I wasn't able to operate much from home during Field Day. On Sunday afternoon, I did manage to work 28 stations on CW and phone, and K4BFT out of Huntsville was one of them. Way to go, ladies. I was on for Field Day, and it showed me the meaning of the drill. Out at the Waterton Amateur Radio site in Littleton, Colorado, we had antenna problems, new radio learning curves, and all sorts of Murphy's Law stuff. Also there during operations were a couple of potential wire licensees and Cynthia Smith, KB2UKM, who ran one of the SSB stations, logged for others, and in general was a great help at the whole site. On another single sideband station, we were 9E, was Martha Tullis, KC0FXI, keeping the YL voice well represented. Let's bump now over to Youth Forum. Always try to get the young folks involved in the recordings every month as well, if possible. This one is titled The Dayton Youth Forum by Carol Perry, WP2MGP. This May 2008 marked the 21st annual Dayton Hamvention Youth Forum. The forum itself, just like the rest of society, has undergone many changes through the years. The interest of the young speakers has changed along with advances in technology. But they all have always stuck with the theme of exciting other young adults to become hams by presenting their own fun experiences in a hobby. Through the years, the support of certain groups and companies has only gotten stronger. Ralph Irish, WAAGDT, representing the Lance Cruz Amateur Radio Club, is a stalwart supporter, donating door prizes, printing the tickets, and bringing lots of love for the kids at the Youth Forum year after year. Mr. Jew and Richard Stubbs from MFJ work with Ralph and his group for their donations and are always very generous in supplying door prizes for the youth in attendance. PICOM has been donating radios, T-shirts, and other door prizes for all the youngsters in the audience for more than 20 years. This year, Maureen Blumkran and Izzy from ICOM helped hand out comic books and ham radio shirts. Maureen also shared stories about her efforts to get school clubs going where she lives. The standing room only forum would not generate the excitement it does without the folks who consistently are there for the kids. The purpose of the youth forum is to have young adults share their ham radio experiences in our hobby and service in the hope of enticing others to join them. This year we had a terrific group of speakers who are a credit to amateur radio. The following objects were used as antennae to make HF contacts using a Kenwood transceiver putting out 75 watts, an oscillating fan, an iron ice spud, a metal pail, a sitting stool, a portable toilet, a cross-cut saw, a shopping cart, logging chains to use to make a dipole antenna. Go figure, huh? A step ladder with chains and wire wrap from one step to another, and a two-wheel dolly. An antenna tuner was also used. Although many of the contacts were made locally, several contacts were made at a good distance away. You could visually see the delight and interest of our audience as the boys described the contacts they had made. They made an HF contact in California with the logging chains, a contact in Florida with the step ladder, and contacts in Kansas using the dolly and shopping cart. We're told that they gave the Kansas contact a 5-9 report as he stated he was putting out 1,000 watts into a very large antenna on a 200-foot tower. May wonders never cease, folks, huh? Young people are the future of amateur radio, and it is an honor and a great bit of fun to be part of that experience. This is from the Youth Forum column in World Radio this month. The author, Carol Perry, called WB2MGP. You can reach her by email at that call sign, wb2mgp@ix.netcom.com. Hey, folks, remember the Hurricane Katrina and Rita disasters? Here's a special event. Southeast Louisiana Amateur Radio Club will operate special event station K5R, Kilo 5 Romeo, 13 September 2008, 1400 Universal Time Constant to 2000 UTC, to commemorate the landfalls of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita along the Gulf Coast in 2005. Frequencies are thereabouts, 7.250 and 14.250, so try to scan the bands and pick them up there, remembering that very devastating natural event. This brings us to the conclusion of Weeding World Radio Magazine for September 2008 in digest form. World Radio is published by Alma Noble. It's headquartered in Sacramento, California. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It's for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. You can reach us at area 763-520-0512, email at handyham@courage.org, or our website, www.handyham.org. Your reader, my name is Bob Zeta. My call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot, Dartmouth, Massachusetts, 73s. And goodbye from Cape Cod.